KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Outer Mission.
I live in the Nastro.
I live in the Mistro.
La Playa.
I live in the Transmission.
Haight-Ashbury.
I'm in the sunny but filthy Mission.
Coming up, the story of a local anchorman struggling with implicit bias.
I did that just a couple of weeks after telling my daughter that people might do that type of thing.
Then people gather in a church in Sunnyvale to confront their own racism.
I'm Mary Ruth, and I'm a racist.
I'm Bonnie, and I'm a racist.
And an ancient dance form jingles onwards in Berkeley.
The hats have ribbons, we also have arm ribbons, and then the bells have ribbons. That's all sort of part of it.
And you have hankies.
And we have hankies.
That's all coming up on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Fear of the other people is at the root of many problems we face around the world. This fear can overwhelm rationality, going beyond what we know is right and not. And it's one of the subjects of the most recent episode of the podcast Invisibilia from NPR. Today, we're going to hear two excerpts set here in the Bay Area that help give some context to what people fear and why and what might be done about it. Here's one of Invisibilia's hosts, Elise Spiegel.
Frank Somerville first encountered his other self on the corner of 25th and Broadway in downtown Oakland. Frank works at the local Fox News station. He anchors the 5, 6, and 10 p.m. newscasts. And in between shifts, he'll sometimes exercise at this small gym down the street. So it was night, around 8 p.m.
I walked out of the gym, and I looked across the street, and there was this white woman sitting at a bus stop. Just maybe a middle-aged white woman. And I saw this black guy walking up the street in the direction of the bus stop.
It immediately struck Frank that there was something suspicious about the man.
You know, I think he had a cap pulled down on his head, and he just dressed kind of like street-ish.
And so Frank paused.
You know what? I'm just going to watch for a second, just to make sure that everything's okay. I'm just going to watch, just in case.
Frank sees himself as a good Samaritan type, the kind of guy who would help if need arose. So he was ready, if the guy pulled anything, to act.
And as he was walking out of my view, and then coming into my view, was a little boy.
Frank remembers the bounce of the little boy's step as he ran to catch up to his father, the happy jumpiness of it.
And I realized, oh my God, he's just the dad. And he's just a dad walking down the street, just like me.
Frank was shocked.
I just stood there, disgusted with myself. I just couldn't believe that that just happened to, of all people, me. And I did that just a couple of weeks after telling my daughter that people might do that type of thing. I mean, what the hell?
You see, Frank Somerville, who's white, has a daughter who's black.
We call her Calzie, but her name's Callie.
A little girl he adopted at birth, who's 12 now. She goes to a performing arts school near Frank's home.
She is very creative, loves music, loves being the center of attention, just kind of loves life.
When Frank and his wife decided to adopt 12 years ago, they already had one daughter, but they had imagined a bigger family, and after struggling to get pregnant, told the adoption agency they were open to any child.
Color didn't matter. It was, we just wanted a child.
Frank grew up in Berkeley during the 1970s, and in the third grade, his school was integrated. All of the white kids were bused to this black school across town. And he says that at first it was really hard.
But by Berkeley High, it was kind of cool because we all were accepted and we were all friends.
This experience left Frank with the strong belief that racially, we were moving forward in this country, and he was part of that movement forward. Which brings us back to Callie.
Calzie, what is it you want? Okay, I love you. Bye. She always does this. She goes, "Dad, finish my lunch and I'm still hungry. So could you bring me a hamburger, some curly fries, and could you bring me a milkshake? And then can you bring a couple of other milkshakes so I can give them to my friends?"
Frank says throughout Callie's childhood, he and his wife didn't talk much about race. They didn't want to make it a huge issue.
It just felt like bursting this innocent little beautiful girl's bubble. And I didn't want to do that.
And then came this.
18-year-old Michael Brown died Saturday after a struggle with an officer.
There had been several deadly police shootings involving black men.
For many, the shootings are proof of police bias.
That is implicit bias.
That bias is at the heart of the issues around policing, Mike Brown, the criminal justice system that have unleashed protests all over the country.
And Frank felt that it was time to have the conversation that many parents of African-American kids have, to spell out to Callie exactly how her race might affect her life.
It's finally time. And so we called her into our living room, right where we're sitting right now.
They told her that because of her race, Callie faced a danger that her white sister didn't, and that if she was ever pulled over by a police officer, she was to do exactly what he said. It wasn't fair, they told her. They knew it wasn't fair. It's just what happens sometimes when a white person encounters someone who's black. It just happens, even if you don't intend it.
You know what? I'm just going to watch for a second just to make sure that everything's okay.
As it happened to Frank that night on the corner of 25th and Broadway.
I'm just going to watch just in case.
And suddenly it hit him.
What the hell?
He, Frank Somerville, had just done the very thing he'd warned his daughter about. He'd judged based on skin color, the thing he feared would haunt his daughter's life, making her options smaller, her days less free. Inside him was a part of himself that he hadn't realized was there and that he definitely did not want. In some part of Frank, there was that thing that they'd been talking about on the news, implicit bias. It was hiding inside him.
Now I come to find out that, well, I've got a little. And so
he had to fight it. For Callie, Frank had to figure out a way to conquer his implicit bias.
I am never, ever, ever going to do that again.
Frank told me that if he could, he'd rip the bias from his body even before his next breath. It was that disgusting to him.
How do you think you would feel if your daughter found out about that moment that you had by the bus stop?
I really don't know the answer to that. I would hope that she wouldn't be disappointed in me. I would hope that she wouldn't feel like I let her down. How I don't know. I don't know how she'd feel.
That was an excerpt from the Invisibilia episode called The Culture Inside. We'll have more for you after this break. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Today we're listening to excerpts from the NPR podcast Invisibilia, all about prejudice. In the last story, we heard one man struggle with his own feelings of implicit bias. Next, we'll hear about a group of people here in the Bay Area who've taken an unconventional approach to tackling racism.
If you're a newcomer or visitor, let us know so that we can welcome you. Now we'll introduce ourselves.
It's 6:45 on a Thursday, and in a small room off the main chapel of the Congregational Church of Sunnyvale in Sunnyvale, California, about 12 people have gathered to change the concepts inside themselves. They sit in a circle, solemn but ready. It's the weekly meeting of Racists Anonymous.
I'm Mary Ruth, and I'm a racist.
I'm Bonnie, and I'm a racist.
I'm Ron, and I'm a racist.
I'm Morgan, and I'm a racist.
I'm May. I am a racist.
There are mostly white people in the room, but more than a third are people of color, all deeply concerned about how the thoughts in their heads might affect the people around them. And so they go through the same drills that any Alcoholics Anonymous meeting would go through. They admit the bad habit that brought them to this meeting and then speak the path forward out loud.
I've made a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself concerning my bias towards others on the basis of race, class, gender, physical attributes, abilities, and sexual orientation.
5. I have admitted to God, to myself, and to another human being the exact nature of my wrongful thoughts and actions.
After they finish reading the steps, an older woman pipes up. She says she's been thinking a lot recently about the mistakes that she's made.
I feel like I have participated so much in racism because there were times I never spoke up.
She talks a little bit about the things that she's seen, the indignities large and small.
I think that's what hurts me the most now, is to have allowed it.
The pastor of the church, Ron Buford, is the person who got Racists Anonymous started after a personal experience in London made him realize that as a black man, there was something very fundamental that he hadn't understood about the world.
While I was over there, I kept thinking, wow, something feels different, you know? It's like, something's different. What is it, you know?
London was actually the first time that Ron had ever been abroad. And there were so many new things, he says for days, he couldn't put his finger on exactly what felt so off. But then one night, he went to a restaurant with a white colleague and noticed that the behavior of the maitre d' didn't feel familiar. Ron could see no difference in eye contact or body language between him and his white friend.
He had not made a decision about who was in control. And it didn't seem to matter to him. He had two people in front of him. He treated us both as people who were going to decide about what to eat and where to go. And that may seem like a small thing, but it's not.
Before Ron was a pastor, he'd worked selling expensive high-tech systems. So he'd actually made a study of how people get treated in restaurants. He felt he had to.
If I had to set up a business lunch, I went to the restaurant ahead of time to ask for the waiter and set things up so that I wouldn't have a humiliating moment when I'm treated with disrespect by a server or a maitre d'. I really, if it was a meeting where we had to do a deal and the power aspects of the meeting were important, I couldn't leave that to chance.
But there he was at this restaurant, and zero difference. Nothing.
Well, that's interesting.
It struck him that there were no ideas in people's head about who he was, or at least none that made them behave as they did in America.
After that, I start noticing it just wasn't happening there anywhere.
Now, Ron says that he knows that the UK isn't a paradise free of racism.
I understand from my friends who are from the Caribbean, who live there, that they do encounter it in some ways.
But as a black American, he says he just couldn't feel it.
It's like going on a race vacation. It was like, you know, this is wonderful. I thought it was really great.
When Ron came home, he says he immediately felt a difference and found himself fantasizing about experiencing that other world again. He wondered if there was anything he could do to affect individual racism. And then one day, Ron was sitting in his office.
We have AA meetings here every day at noon, some days twice. And I'd sit here because the walls are thin, and I'd hear him saying the Lord's Prayer and so forth. And I thought, what if this is like alcoholism?
What if the implicit racism of individuals in the U.S. could be thought of as a disease brought on by habitual behavior? Habitual behavior that we as a culture learned while other cultures hadn't learned it.
And we need to unlearn it.
So you said I want to help people unlearn these behaviors.
That's right. That's right.
So Ron established Racists Anonymous based on Alcoholics Anonymous, reasoning that though AA has had plenty of failures, it's had real successes too.
Do people fail at it? Yes. But it's a way.
Keep coming back. It works.
So maybe you think the idea of approaching prejudice like this, like a bad habit, sounds ridiculous. Super California and eye-rolly. Maybe it seems that way. But it's not.
It is a habit. It's something that the more it's been done in the past, the stronger it is in your mind and the more automatic it becomes.
Will Cox studies prejudice at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's part of a group of researchers who approach prejudice literally as a habit akin to fingernail biting or smoking. They see it as a mental habit, but a habit learned in exactly the same way that you learn anything.
These kinds of unintentional biases, they're very ordinary. They come from our ordinary learning mechanisms.
See, the way that we learn anything, according to Will, is by repeatedly associating one thing, one concept, with another thing, another concept.
So if you're learning your multiplication tables and you know, the teacher says 2 times 2 is 4.
What happens in your brain is that the neurons that house the concept 2 activate and connect with the neurons in your brain that house the other concepts in that sentence, times and 4.
And that's what learning is. It's building of connections among neurons in your brain.
So every time that you encounter that idea,
2 times 2 is 4.
It rehearses those times tables in your brain as you hear them and then as you kind of think about them in your own mind.
And the more you encounter these concepts together, the stronger the connection gets. Which brings us to stereotypes.
So like the association between black men and criminality, between those two concepts, that would be a stereotype.
In our culture, those two concepts, black men and criminality, get linked all the time. In fact, they're often linked out of proportion to the degree to which they actually exist in society.
So for instance, if a crime is reported on the news, if the crime was committed by a black person, it's actually twice as likely that they'll show a picture of the person who committed the crime than if it was committed by a white person.
Basically, our culture has spent a lot of time teaching us to connect those two concepts. And so they often are connected in our minds.
I'm just going to watch, just in case.
That was an excerpt of the Invisibilia episode called The Culture Inside. To hear the full episode, head to the NPR podcast directory on their website, npr.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. If you passed by Christ Church in Berkeley on a Tuesday evening, you might be intrigued by some of the sounds coming out of the stylish old building. And if you ventured inside, you'd encounter a dance lesson. But this isn't the kind of dance you see on TV.
Dancing with the Stars.
Nope, this is the world of Morris dancing.
It's a traditional English folk dance, and it's done usually in groups of 6 to 8 people.
That's Beth Bergen. She lives in Alameda.
And I've been ballroom dancing for about 15 years and Morris dancing for about 8.
Berkeley Morris has a summer solstice performance tonight. To hear more, we're headed to our archives. KALW's Stephen Short went to visit the Berkeley Morris to learn more about this ancient dance form.
Morris dancing.
seemingly an innocent pub pastime involving hanky-waving bearded men? Or rather, is it an aggressively contested contact sport?
That's a clip from a comedy film called Morris, A Life with Bells On. Morris dancing is hardly as sinister as this implies, but even the practitioners admit to it being, well, eccentric. Beth Bergen says that's part of the appeal.
Morris is one of the more goofy styles of folk dancing. So if you like traditional folk dancing and you like the bells and hankies and sticks and patterns, it's really a fun time.
Bells and hankies and sticks.
Well, there's two styles of dances. There's handkerchiefs, which are waved up and down and snapped in precision time, usually in time with the music. And there's stick dances, where each dancer will have one or two sticks, and they're clashed in a certain pattern or tossed.
I would say it's certainly eccentric.
Roger Avery of San Ramon is here to introduce some new styles of Morris.
Yes, it's going to do some dances from the village of Headington. Actually, technically, it's called Headington Quarry, and it's just outside Oxford, the city of Oxford. The Morris book, Lionel Bacon's book, he talks about it being brisk, neat, compact, and I've actually danced with Headington, the quarrymen themselves, and it is very tight.
While this particular dance is new to this particular group, the origins of Morris dancing are lost in the mists of time.
There are records going back to the 1200s. It's in the church records in England, back in 1600s, some earlier. Ready,
Shakespeare referred to Morris dancing. Some claim it goes back to the Ice Age. The truth is, nobody knows. The music that goes with it can be sparse, just a flute or a type of accordion called a melodeon. And, according to Pleasant Hill resident Randall Cayford, foreman of Berkeley Morris, it might also include fife and drum, mandolin, fiddle, and or concertina. But what about those costumes?
Well, we call them knickers. That's not what they call them in England. But they're basically pants that have been cut off at just below the knee. And so we have black socks, black knee socks, white knickers, and red vests, and black hats. The hats have ribbons, we also have arm ribbons, and then the bells have ribbons. That's all sort of part of it.
And you have hankies.
And we have hankies. When we're not using sticks, we have hankies.
And there are those bells.
It's a leather pad with a row of bells. These are on fishing hook sort of split rings, just because they bounce better and they last longer. It's a very traditional. Morris teams have bells. That's one of their defining characteristics, is you wear bells on your shins. We also have a hobby animal, which is also very traditional in Morris. In our case, it's a bear, so we have a hobby bear because we're in California.
Not a hobby horse, but a hobby bear.
Exactly. Hobby horses are far more traditional, but we're in California, so we have a bear.
The hobby bear is the team's mascot.
It's part of the performance. It's part of the pageantry. They're the precursors that in American culture have been left over as team mascots.
Lucy, the bear, dances around from time to time, especially at the beginning of the spring dance season, when both bears and Morris dancers awaken from hibernation.
The music is very traditional, and I know that Morris dancing goes way back, but where does this music come from?
I was told that a lot of this was the popular music of the 1800s, that this is music hall popular tunes. So this would be the top 40s.
So they've kept up with the times in that sense.
They keep up with the times. Most of the dances most teams are doing are new. There are a lot of traditional dances, but it's a living tradition that is continually inventing both new dance steps and new dances and new styles.
So there's always more to learn.
Bob Orser practices Morris dance in Berkeley and Santa Cruz. He knows about the old mingling with the new. He came to the ritual known as Morris when he was
51, and I'm 80 now. I turned 80 last January. So it keeps you in shape. It keeps you from getting old. I recommend it. You know, just anyone who's in their 50s now, 40s or 50s, should start doing it, and then they'll live forever, like me.
And with every leap, jingle, and wave of their hankies, these dancers extend the life of this age-old folk custom known as Morris. Capering about in Berkeley, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
Berkeley Morris has a summer solstice performance tonight. They'll be dancing at sunset in San Francisco's Sutro Heights Park. All that information is at kalw.org and click Cross Currents. That's all we have for Cross Currents. Our team for today includes China Armstrong, Nina Gensler-Debs, Leela Day, Angela Johnston, Marina Poole, James Rowland, Stephen Short, Lisa Morehouse, Judy Silber, Corinne Smith, and Andrew Stelzer. The show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley-Ma. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Foxtails Brigade. They play at Amnesia in San Francisco on Friday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.